You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Thord,
Corey Doctorow,
Brandon Sanderson,
Robin Mom,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is... Authors, I have a fantastic new service to tell you about. It's called PubSite. PubSite is a service to help you build your very own website, your home on the web, where you can promote your work and give your fans a place to connect with you. PubSite is a website platform that allows every author, regardless of budget, to have a great-looking professional website. Developed by the book marketing professionals at FSB Associates, PubSite is the new easy-to-use DIY website builder developed specifically for books and authors. Whether you're an author of one book or 20, or a small publisher, PubSite allows you to build, design, and most importantly, update your website pain-free. No need to be dependent on a designer or webmaster to make a small but costly change to your website. Save the money and do it yourself. PubSite is the best platform for authors because it's a book-centric platform. PubSite was built just for authors and small publishers. Every design, feature, and layout is book-centric. They have customized designs for you to use. It's easy to build. No coding or HTML is necessary to create a stunning, professional-looking website with all the features you want. Get a custom domain name, yourname.com. It's simple to update. You can add all of your books, add a blog and a book tour, sell from any retailer, manage your email list and social media, and even do e-commerce. Build your website with a 14-day free trial, then pay just $19.99 per month, which includes hosting. And we offer packages starting at $499 to set up the website for you. Pub-site.com, the place to help authors find their home on the web. The Feisty Heroine Romance Collection of Short Stories. Over 30 plus pulse racing shorts to capture your heart with USA Today, The Wall Street Journal, New York Times, and award-winning authors in the mix. Paranormal, contemporary, fantasy, and historical romance that will whet your appetite with titillating, heart-pounding tales you'll want to read again, then beg for more. Fall in love with your next book crush. Pre-order this amazing collection of shorts, over 30 pulse-pounding stories, for only 99 cents.
Proceed with caution. Buying this collection may lead to addictive reading, falling in love with your next book crush, and staying up past your bedtime to see what happens next.
Get your limited edition copy of Feisty Heroines. Look for the link in the show notes of this episode. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm really excited to have Michael McAuliffe on the show with me. He's got a fantastic new book, a legal thriller called No Truth Left to Tell. And I'll tell you what, this is one of my favorite books so far of 2020, and I think you guys are going to love it as well. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Well, thanks for having me, and thanks for your thanks for the compliment.
Absolutely. Michael, we begin each show with the same question, and that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
Well, my first memory of wanting to be a storyteller, and I think that is it's a great term, more broader than a writer, is when I was young and my parents would read to me and to my brothers, and I was entertained, I was comforted, and you make a connection. So I think at a fairly young age as a child, I learned to love listening to stories, and that evolved over time into trying to have my own stories to tell.
Absolutely. And we use that term storyteller because it doesn't always manifest as, you know, wanting to write your first novel right away or whatever. But there's something that awakens in some of us that just want to express that gift of communication. And that's I love that you had a family and an upbringing where, the oral storytelling was, had a place. Were you a bookish kid? Did you read a lot as a kid?
I think I read a fair amount. I wouldn't say I was over enthused or indulged in setting up in a corner and to the exclusion of running around outside or other competing interests at the time. But over time, I did learn and get the sense that the more you read, the more you understand, the more you appreciate. And then as a student of writing and communication, it's an essential proposition that you need to read to be a better writer and storyteller. So as I grew older, I started reading for utilitarian purposes and then for the storytelling. And that's a powerful combination when you put it all together and say you're learning something, you're enjoying it, and then you're making yourself a better storyteller as a result.
You have worked your day job for more than 30 years as an attorney, and I can't think of another profession that relies on communication as strongly as practicing law does. What was it that drew you to the law?
Well, I knew I always loved the idea that the rules of the road or the compact that we all make with each other to live in a community, ultimately in the society, all comes down to agreement about those rules and then a way to resolve disputes when you disagree. And so the law to me is so central to our lives that it drew it. I was drawn to it in part because of that central proposition of importance. And I also think that the law is a way that you protect people and that you express your commitment to one another. And so those were some of the original reasons. I have to admit that I, like many, many other lawyers, read To Kill a Mockingbird and thought that, gee, what a wonderful way of making a contribution to society is being a skilled advocate within that legal framework. And of course, Atticus Finch was a defense attorney, and over time I morphed into thinking similarly about the high calling of being an ethical prosecutor.
Now, being an ethical prosecutor, why do you make that distinction?
Well, I think prosecutors, and I use that term generically, at the state and federal levels, you wield so much power. You have the authority and the resources of government behind you to train your interest or focus on an individual or a company and accuse them publicly of wrongdoing. So with that authority and discretion comes great responsibility, and I think how you exercise that responsibility and how you show restraint is the hallmark of the American justice system. And when it goes off the rails, when people are abusive of that power, it goes to the heart of the difficulties we face in a free society. So being an ethical prosecutor to me is one of the great central propositions of a healthy democracy.
Love that. A lot of us who read To Kill a Mockingbird when we were younger, maybe watched Perry Mason reruns, different things, portrayals of attorneys like that, get this idea that being an attorney is all courtroom battles and, up and down drama every day. But it's not like that day in and day out, is it?
No, there are different types of lawyers. There are corporate lawyers, business lawyers. There are lawyers that do most of their work, if not all, outside of a courtroom. Courtroom and trial lawyers focus around disputes that people or entities have disagreements and that you become one party or a number of parties advocate in a particular case or dispute. So, and even in even within trial lawyers, most trial lawyers, even the name trial lawyer might be a bit of a misnomer. You don't usually try that many cases because most cases get resolved short of trial.
Also, during your time that you've practiced as an attorney, you also are an alpine mountaineer. What is that that call to this sense of adventure that took you there?
I think mountaineering is one of those experiences that when I my wife for my 40th birthday gave me a mountaineering course, and that's really what introduced me to that world, that life. That I live in some ways apart from my my professional life, for sure. I have friends from mountain climbing that I consider lifelong close friends that you don't see very often off the mountain. But mountaineering is this wonderful alchemy of, and I think this is reflected in the book in a passage of individualism. Nobody can climb a mountain for you. You have to take every step by yourself. But yet in most mountaineering scenarios, you are roped together with other climbers. So you're utterly dependent on the support and the good decision-making and safety of other people for your own success, sometimes for your own life.
Wow. Have you ever found yourself in a hairy situation on the side of a mountain?
Yes, I have.
Does that leave you with, when you're back on the ground safely, do you look back on that experience and think, oh God, that's going to make a good story one day?
You do, although that's probably not what you're thinking in the moment.
Right.
Sure. One of the things about mountaineering is when you're about a week into a long expedition climb, you are thinking to yourself, why am I here? please get me off this mountain. But you keep going and hopefully you achieve your objective. Certainly your first objective is to come back alive with all your fingers and toes. And then 3 or 4 weeks after this great adventure, you then are starting to conspire and think about how to get back on a mountain. It's an odd feeling of intense emotion and physical challenge.
In the years that you practiced law, you kind of wound up in Florida and settled there. Is that right?
Yes, I've been practicing about 30 years as a lawyer, and first in Washington D.C. and then overseas teaching for a year, and then we moved south to where my wife is from in South Florida, and have been in South Florida for 25 years, I believe.
Wow. The farther south you go in Florida, the less it looks like the American South, or at least the Southeast, what most people kind of consider the American South. And the book that you wrote, No Truth Left to Tell, takes place in Louisiana. And I'm from South Mississippi, so this is very close to where I grew up, and stories that I'm familiar with, and this book really resonates very clearly with some of our experiences here in this part of the country. Being in South Florida, what kind of led you to this story, and have you ever experienced anything in your years as an attorney that kind of rings true to this story that you wrote?
Well, I think the backstory to that is when I was a young lawyer out of law school, I joined the Justice Department in Washington, D.C. in the criminal section of the Civil Rights Division. And that section indeed had responsibility for investigating and prosecuting at the federal level hate crimes, violent acts that were animus-based or based on hate. Police misconduct cases, and then also cases that we now know as human trafficking, but we really called them involuntary servitude and peonage cases back when I was starting. So the book itself is loosely based on my experiences traveling around the South and investigating and prosecuting those types of cases. So I will tell you that I did, in fact, investigate and prosecute the head of the Ku Klux Klan in Louisiana for a series of hate crimes. Now the book is fiction, and it's meant to be read as fiction, but the issues and some of the personality traits and the characters are lifted from my life experiences.
Wow. So I was going to ask you, of course, if the character of Adrian Rush, who is our kind of main protagonist in the book, had any connection to you, but obviously he does, at least in informing the story and the character. But how do you know, when you're dealing with something this this traumatic and this that's kind of indelible on your memory and your psyche, how do you separate yourself from the character of Adrian Rush?
Yeah, that's a great question, and it actually tracks my experience as a writer. When I originally started writing the novel after decades of wanting to tell a story relating to my early experiences, not just my experiences, but what I observed in others also, I think I made the mistake of adhering too closely to fact and not feeling free as a novelist, as a writer, to create a world that the characters could inhabit and make decisions and do things, trip and fall and pick themselves back up again. And it took me a long time to revisit the story and to allow myself the freedom as a writer to fully form characters that in some way had some connection, had some thread in common with people I once knew or worked with, or victims that I had once come across in my former role as a federal civil rights prosecutor. But I think once I gave myself that freedom to actually be a fiction writer and then tried to become better at it, that's when I hope the story got better and you see the result of it.
Well, and by giving yourself time and distance from your real life experiences, I can only assume that allowed you to build better, fully formed characters, more that are not just two dimensional representations of this is the good guy, this is the bad guy. And, you know, because the characters in this book really resonate as real human beings with their faults and their foibles and their accomplishments and their fears. And you really did a good job on, you know, painting a canvas that's believable.
Well, thanks. That was the goal. I very much aspired to create characters that were not binary, you know, that it's not pure right, pure wrong. You know, it deals with the story in the novel deals with difficult issues of race and police misconduct, but also law enforcement officers doing heroic things in some instances. The protagonist is certainly, a complex person who's young, ambitious, doesn't quite know what he doesn't know, and has to learn along the way from lessons of life and even the law during the course of the story.
Right. The character of Adrian Rush, like you in real life, was not from Louisiana there. What brings him there, and who does he encounter?
So Adrian Rush is sent to Louisiana, to Linwood, to investigate a series of cross burnings that the Klan had done over the course of a single night as the opening movement in what they hoped was a new race war. And Adrian is a member of the criminal section of the Civil Rights Division at the Department of Justice, real section. And it is empowered and has the responsibility of investigating those types of matters in conjunction with the U.S. Attorney's offices around the whole country. And so he is sent from D.C. down into Louisiana. And he's young. I think Adrian is smart and is wants to do the right thing, but he also has a no small dose of ambition, thinking that if he's successful in prosecuting the Klan, that will be it'll be good for his career. And of course, his life becomes a little more complicated along the way because he falls for one of the victims' granddaughters. He has a complicated and contentious relationship with the FBI agent who's from the local office, who is a bit grizzled, experienced, smart, African American, and views Adrian Rush as a little bit of a, not a little bit, a lot of as an interloper in the whole affair.
Right. And it's really funny to see how well you crafted the feelings of unrest, you know, with an outsider, even an outsider who ultimately is trying to do the right thing and help. There's still this idea of you know, mistrust that you know, are people's you know, motivations as pure as they say they are? Was that something that you really worked on in this book?
I did. I really feel very strongly that there are communities that over time become insular, either culturally or otherwise, economically isolated. I think that the South is a complicated. There are some parts of the South that are just so rich in tradition and history and on the good side of the ledger, and then it has the legacy of some of the issues that are addressed in the book: the racism, the bigotry, the backwards looking perspective, and you know, it's a jumble thrown together creates drama and friction. You know, and I wanted to portray this fictional town of Linwood in some of that complexity and to make the reader, to draw the reader in, and hopefully the reader appreciates that that good and evil, you know, isn't always so clear. There are shades of it. Now, of course, you know, the Klan is the Klan, and there's a good reason why the Klan is the epitome of American domestic terrorism. But I wanted to get under the hood, and I don't mean the car hood, I mean the Klan hood, to see what makes some of these folks tick. And that insight, I think, can be entertaining in the storyline, but I hope is insightful in some of the discussions that we're going through nationally now.
What's really interesting, as someone who's lived in the South and has kind of watched, you know, this play out over, you know, nearly 50 years, is that the Klan are an extremely small, insular, isolated group of people that make a lot of noise. And they're not just in the South. There's, you know, chapters of the Klan all over the country. But for some reason, I don't know if it's the history, if it's the clandestine, you know, sort of nature of it all, but these very small groups of people still have the ability to instill fear and terror. What do you think it is about these groups of people, or the nature of this group, that makes them resurgent, that they just never seem to completely die, and that they wield this sort of power even though their numbers are extremely small in comparison to the rest of the population?
I think it's the nature of the organization. It has become imprinted in America's DNA that it's almost symbolic, well beyond, well, the numbers of Klan members. You know, back in the 20s, the Klan was a thriving, quote unquote, mainstream organization that had over 4 million members to it. Now, that was in the second incarnation of the Klan. And so it had this veneer of legitimacy. I do think it's racial extremist views is evergreen in its attraction to a small group of folks who are really wanting to define themselves as better than some other groups. And you can make your choice as to what group, what minority group or other that they feel better than. So some of it's philosophical and exclusionary, and then some of it is just a convenient way to justify hurting other people.
Right, right. The core of the story here for me was the not only the dealing with this specific issue that that is striking fear, but the way the characters in the story change and learn to trust each other and learn that depending on each other is really where the freedom comes from. Tell me a little bit about the character growth in this. We talked about making kind of very realistic characters and fully formed characters. How did you think about the character trajectories through writing this book?
Well, one of my favorite characters is Lee Mercer, the FBI agent. I think that he, in my mind, grew over time within that fictional community and reality. And Agent Mercer, I think, plays a pivotal role in the story arc, both in his relationship with the protagonist, Adrian Rush, but also symbolically. That he has weathered a lot in his life, and for the readers of the book, ultimately he becomes very important in terms of the sacrifices that are made in the story. I also think Nettie Wynn, who someone described to me as a saint-like figure, is for me embodies many of the victims of racial or bias-based violence. Who through how they survive, how they react, their generosity of spirit, their maturity, their spirituality, teach us all a grace. And so Nettie Wynn is another one of my particular favorite characters in the book that that I hope over the course of the story grows and becomes very personal to a reader.
Michael, let's talk about the writing of the book just for a minute. Did you have a plan for the book from the beginning? Did you outline it how much pre-writing went into the book before you actually started writing the novel?
Yeah, I would say there was a lot more on the other end of the rewriting. The story itself has been something that I'd wanted to write about and pursue for almost 30 years. It really was 3 years in the actual creation, writing and rewriting process. And I had to learn to write like a creative writer, not like a lawyer. And I think that took some time in and of itself. So I do though accept the principle, the notion that good writing is rewriting, and then you have to be open to changing direction or lopping off chapters that and sometimes people that you might even care about, but that don't serve the story or the reader's experience, and that's a humbling process. So the mechanic, time frame wise, it was about 3 years of focused, diligent work to try to create the story that we have in the book.
Well, it's fantastic. I absolutely love the book. After finishing this book, will there be more novels from you? Did you kind of get bitten by the bug?
I definitely have the aspiration and hope and intent to continue writing as a novelist, and I have been working on a sequel or another book involving Adrian Rush and human trafficking. And then I also have working on a story about the Velvet Revolution in the former Czechoslovakia after after the fall of communism and what happened in the Czech Republic after it broke off from Slovakia, and people who had been in exile for decades coming back and finding their properties appropriated and belonging to people they grew up with, and their attempts to get it back. So yes, I definitely have the bug, and now I hope I've learned the craft well enough that I'm worthy of a subsequent novel.
Well, the book is called No Truth Left to Tell. I absolutely love this book. I'm recommending it to everyone. There's links to it in the show notes of this episode. It's available everywhere now. When you're hearing this, Michael, if people are just learning about you and want to connect with all that you do, is there a place where they can connect with you online?
They can. The easiest way to find out about the book and me in terms of my background is you can just type in No Truth Left to Tell, and it'll go to the book's website. You could also type in michaelfmcauliffe.com, and that will come to me. And on that site, you can sign up for to follow me and to get in contact with me. So then I intend to reach out to folks who have signed up, so you'll get special attention.
Excellent, excellent. We'll put links to all that great stuff in the show notes of this episode. Michael, this has been so much fun talking. Thank you so much for taking time to come on the show.
Oh, it's an honor. Thank you.
Stay tuned now for an audiobook excerpt from Richard Fox's The Ember War.
The near future. The probe slowed as the sun's heliosphere disrupted the graviton wave it rode in on from the abyss of deep space. Awakened by the sudden deceleration, the probe absorbed the electromagnetic spectrum utilized by its target species and assessed the technological sophistication of the sole sentient species on Earth. The probe adjusted its course to take it into the system's primary. If the humans couldn't survive, with its help, what was to come? Then the probe would annihilate itself. There would be no trace of it for the enemy, and no chance of humanity's existence beyond the time it had until the enemy arrived. The probe analyzed filed patents, military expenditures, birth rates, mathematical advancement, and space exploration. The first assessment fell within the margin of error of survival and extinction for humanity. The probe's programming allowed for limited, autonomous decision-making, choice being a rare luxury for the probe's class of artificial intelligence. The probe found itself in a position to choose between ending its mission in the sun's fire and a mathematically improbable defense of humanity, and the potential compromise of its much larger mission. Given the rare opportunity to make its own decision, the probe opted to dither. In the week it took to pass into Jupiter's orbit, the probe took in more data. It scoured the internet for factors to add to the assessment, but the assessment remained the same. Unlikely, but possible. By the time it shot past Mars, the probe still hadn't made a decision. As the time to adjust course for Earth or continue into the sun approached, the probe conducted a final scan of cloud storage servers for any new information, and found something interesting. While the new information made only a negligible impact on the assessment, the probe adjusted course to Earth. It hadn't traveled all this way for nothing. In the desert south of Phoenix, Arizona, it landed with no more fanfare than a slight thump and a few startled cows. Then it broke into the local cell network and made a call. Mark Ibarra awoke to his phone ringing at max volume, playing a pop ditty that he hated with vehemence. He rolled off the mattress that lay on the floor.
and crawled on his hands and knees to where his cell was recharging. His roommate, who paid the majority of their rent and got to sleep on an actual bed, grumbled and let off a slew of slurred insults. Mark reached his cell and slapped at it until the offending music ended. He blinked sleep from his eyes and tried to focus on the caller's name on the screen. The only people who'd call at this ungodly hour were his family in Basque country, or maybe Jessica in his applied robotics course wanted a late-night study break. The name on the screen was Answer Me. He closed an eye and reread the name. It was way too early, or too late, depending on one's point of view, for this nonsense. He turned the ringer off and went back to bed. Sleep was about to claim him when the phone rang again, just as loudly as last time, but now with a disco anthem.
Seriously?
His roommate slurred. Mark declined the call and powered the phone off. He flopped back on his bed and curled into his blanket.
To hell with my first class, he thought.
Arizona State University had a lax attendance policy, one which he'd abused for nights like this. The cell erupted with big band music. Mark took his head out from beneath the covers and looked at his phone like it was a thing possessed. The phone vibrated so hard that it practically danced a jig on the floor, and the screen flashed Answer Me over and over again as music blared.
Dude,
said his roommate, now sitting up in his bed. Mark swiped the phone off the charging cord, and the music stopped. The caller's name undulated with a rainbow of colors, and an arrow appeared on the screen, pointing to the button he had to press to answer the call.
When did I get this app? He thought.
Mark sighed and left the bedroom, meandering into the hallway bathroom with the grace of a zombie. The battered mattress he slept on played hell with his back and left him stiff every morning. Dropping his boxers, he took a seat on the toilet and answered the call, determined to return this caller's civility with some interesting background noise.
What?
He murmured. Mark Ibarra, I need to see you. The voice was mechanical, asexual in its monotone.
Do you have any friggin' idea what time it is? Wait, who the hell is this?
You must come to me immediately. We must discuss the mathematical proof you have stored in document title This Can't Be Right. Doc.
Mark shot to his feet. The boxers around his ankles tripped him up, and he stumbled out of the bathroom and fell against the wall. His elbow punched a hole in the drywall, and the cell clattered to the floor. He scooped the phone back up and struggled to breathe as a sudden asthma attack came over him.
How?
He couldn't finish his question until he found his inhaler in the kitchen, mere steps away in the tiny apartment. He took a deep breath from the inhaler and felt the tightness leave his lungs. That someone knew of his proof was impossible. He'd finished it earlier that night and had encrypted it several times before loading it into a cloud file that shouldn't have been linked to him in any way.
How do you know about that?
He asked.
You must come to me immediately. There is little time. Look at your screen, the robotic voice said. His screen changed to a map program, displaying a pin in an open field just off the highway, connecting Phoenix to the suburb of Maricopa. Come. Now.
Mark grabbed his keys. An hour later, his jeans ripped from scaling a barbed wire fence, Mark was surrounded by desert scrub. The blue of the morning rose behind him, where his beat-up Honda waited on the side of the highway. With his cell to
it... Some things you write now, do they differ in the writing process from...
Plants looked a lot like benign mesquite trees in the darkness. A Native American casino in the distance served as his North Star, helping him keep his bearings.
You're not out here, are you? I'm being punked, aren't I? He asked the mysterious caller.
You are 9.26 meters to my east-southeast. Punk. Decayed wood. Used as tinder. Are you on fire? The caller said.
Mark rolled his eyes. This wasn't the first time the caller had used the non-standard meanings of words during what passed as conversation between the two. Mark had tried to get the caller to explain how he knew about his theorem and why they had to meet in the middle of the desert. The caller had refused to say anything. He would only reiterate that Mark had to come quickly to see him, chiding him every time Mark deviated from the provided driving directions.
If you're so close, why can't I see you? He asked.
He took a few steps in what he thought was a northwesterly direction and squished into a cow paddy.